I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. On today's show, I'll welcome longtime Entertainment Weekly movie critic Owen Gleiberman. He's just published his first book, a reflection on the brutal, often brittle, life of the American movie critic. It's called Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies. Stick around and prepare to match reviews and wits with another American man who recognizes the genius that is Russ Meyers. If you thought that Straight Outta Compton was an at times brutal account of the entertainment business, ready yourself for the all-out brawl that is Owen Gleiberman versus Pauline Kael and her acolytes. Okay, I'm kidding. Yeah, mostly. Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies, is a compelling memoir of an accidental movie critic, a young man who discovered comfort in dark theaters as a boy and never left it even as an adult. What struck me about Movie Freak was the parallel between Gleiberman's film experiences from adolescence on to high school and into college, and my own. Part of that is our similarity in age. Part is having had the good luck to be mentored and steered at critical times in our early careers. As I was reading the book, I kept telling my wife, replace Michigan, where Gleiberman grew up, with New Jersey, and University of Michigan with University of Miami, and this might as well be my life through being a freshman in college. To which my wife would shrug, roll her eyes, and return to Top Chef. Gleiberman is best known to film fans as the first film critic at a little magazine named Entertainment Weekly, a position he held for more than two decades, even though he trashed Pretty Woman. Not that I loved it either, but I wasn't in a position to influence millions, just tens. I especially loved the backstage editorial anecdotes and sniping he shares from his time at the predominant entertainment zine in the country. The book also doesn't shy from revealing the author's porn addiction in college, love of cocaine as a young adult, and for many years, his inability to commit to any woman for longer than 6 months. That's changed, by the way. By the way, you gotta respect a man who admits his job ain't exactly that tough. Owen Gleiberman, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks, Bob. That was a great summary of the book. Seriously, you nailed it. And yeah, there's something about that generational thing. I think, you know, movies change over time. The way we see them changes over time. And I think, you know, those of us who kind of came of age in the 70s, maybe very early 80s, gives us a special relationship to that whole thing.
So you agree Robert Wills should get the Kennedy honors for The Hollywood Nights?
That we don't agree on.
I had to start with the important stuff. So you had me in the book at a drive-in movie theater watching Rosemary's Baby with your parents, age 9. I mean, it really was a different time. I went through the same thing. I couldn't believe, in retrospect, the films that my parents took me to see at the drive-in or let me go see without them.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. My parents started going to these drive-in movies right when Hollywood movies were growing up in the mid to late 60s. I mean, it was really, you know, it happened a little before Bonnie and Clyde. That really kind of made it official. But it was starting in about 66, the beginning of 67. And I was 8 years old and then 9 years old the summer of 68. And I saw Rosemary's Baby. The way I put it in the book is, you know, I watched the devil rape Rosemary before I knew what the devil or rape was. And I watched The Boston Strangler and found myself drawn into this strange kind of identification with the hero. I mean, the hero, the strangler. Yeah. That's what the movie did. The movie asked you to sort of see him in a funny way as a sympathetic character. But when you're 9 years old, that was a very strange place to be in. I joke in the book, or only half joke, that my parents deciding to take somebody my age to these movies, I mean, basically because they wanted to see them, I was just schlepped in the back seat. And they were, I guess, too lazy to get a babysitter or something. I joke that it was borderline child abuse. But in a way, it might have been. I think if I had been a different kid, it might have affected me differently. It might have truly traumatized me or just messed me up in some way. Maybe it did. But the real point is that I didn't feel traumatized. Instead, I was fascinated. I was drawn into these movies. I guess I was just precocious enough that even though they were so far beyond me, I did, on some level, relate to the adult subject matter. I kind of plugged into what was happening in these movies and wanted to understand them. And I think they fed a sort of lifelong addiction in me about where I'm at with movies and maybe, you know, certain aspects of just who I am as a person, in that they made me feel that movies were this curtain being drawn back onto this dark, forbidden world, that you were going to see these ultimate fascinating secrets about the way that things really were. And I think that that is part of the appeal of movies. I think that always has been there. I mean, I think the best example I can think of, excuse me, from classic Hollywood, say, would be film noir. I mean, one of the reasons those movies still seem so timeless, apart from just that they're really great movies, is that they were always about a character like, you know, Fred McMurray in Double Indemnity being drawn into this world of sexuality and sort of this dark allure that he'd never even considered before. That's intrinsic to the appeal of movies, and but it had been ratcheted up in the transgressive thing, and I think it never left me. And those, as you'll see, anyone who reads the book and kind of sees my movie tastes all through my adult life, it was really marked by that. It's not the only kind of movies I liked, but those were the movies that I really developed a Jones for.
It's funny that of all the movies in the world that you could have mentioned, my wife and I watched Double Indemnity this past week again with our 19-and-a-half-year-old college student son. The second time we'd seen it with him, but he was actually had to write about it for a college class. So we just watched that again, and that movie, those James M. Cain films in general, just astonishing. But I want to go back to Rosemary's Baby, and I want to ask you about the film that I'm sure scarred me for a while. That I still can't believe my parents dropped me and a buddy off at the movie theater, unquestioning what we were going to see at a time when there were only single theaters, so it was not like going to a multiplex. The movie was Tales from the Crypt, 1972.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't sleep. I swear I didn't sleep for 2 or 3 years.
Right.
I mean, the beating heart in somebody's hand. I believe that was a real beating heart. I mean, it's horrible that, you know.
Well, it's either horrible or it's something about being that age and watching horror movies, because I have some other examples of things that weren't even my parents taking me to forbidden movies at the drive-in, but things in the area of horror that I saw either, you know, from like 5 to 10 years old or maybe into early teenagehood years where, yes, I would get terrified. I have one memory of I watched X, the Man with X-Ray Eyes on television when I was like 6 or 7, and I was just haunted by that movie. But there are other examples. I would watch, you know, our local Saturday afternoon creature feature with a guy in a Dracula suit and, you know, watch Godzilla movies and stuff like that and actually find them very enthralling. But once in a while, I saw something there that really scared the shit out of me. Like, for instance, Black Sunday was one. I mean, I remember I literally jumped off the couch in fright at one point in that movie. But there were also Night Gallery episodes that would do that to me. So I just find that, you know, when you're at a certain age, horror can really do that to you. I mean, I can't imagine what the horror movies of today do to kids who see them, you know, because, I mean, we all know that this happens. There are probably 12-year-olds that sneak in to see, you know, Saw 4. And I can't imagine what that does to them. I think probably something much worse than Rosemary's Baby or The Boston Strangler did to me, because in hindsight, the films that I saw at the drive-in or even some of the kinds of horror movies you're talking about, they might have been pretty extreme, but there was a certain humanity to them because it was just less about the gore, less – you're right. There was that moment with the beating heart, but it was the only moment like that in the movie. It wasn't like 90 minutes of beating hearts and torn limbs. So there was a certain humanity to the films then. I think now culture is so extreme that – I have to say, I wonder about what it does to kids just in terms of desensitizing them.
Well, speaking of which, I have to ask, you're a dad, right?
I am.
I mean, would you let your kid go to see, I mean, anything these days without, you know, having known what's in it or gotten, you know, reviewed it? I can't imagine that despite our shared history of seeing perhaps inappropriate things that you would send your own kid now to see things without knowing what it's about and...
I'm pretty conservative about it, and my oldest daughter, who's 5, I mean, she's still even too young where I even have to consider that stuff. I mean, you know, it took a lot of convincing to get her to go see Inside Out, and I think that even seemed a little too adult for her. But yeah, I do wonder about that stuff. And right now, I have my youngest daughter is 3. Right now, I can shield them from all of that, and I think I will remain pretty cautious about what I allow them to see. At the same time, when they're that young, you can do that. I mean, we do live in a culture now where kids just go off on their own and watch God knows what on the internet. And I don't just say this as a parent. I've always been disturbed by that. I've always been very conservative about that, because I think in many ways, and I part ways with a lot of critics in this regard, critics get so defensive about pop culture that they always have to defend it. I mean, they defend it on First Amendment grounds and even on other grounds. I don't. I actually think a lot of pop culture is incredibly harmful. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book, for instance, is that there was a sort of irony to the precise moment in my generation when I came along. I'm sort of right on the cusp between the boomers and Gen X. So I watched all these horror movies in the 70s. By the time I was in college, I was plugging into stuff like Texas Chainsaw and things like that. So I was your definition of a teenager or guy in his early 20s who was a major horror maven. That's really the age for horror, because horror movies are really all about sex. And I don't know, there's something about if you're a guy that age, you plug into horror movies. So that was me. But then, as soon as I arrived at the Boston Phoenix, where I had my first job, and I literally started there at the beginning of 1981, the week I turned 22, so I was still a young guy, this was at the beginning of the 80s, when all these slasher movies were coming out. I had to review all of them. I considered myself a horror aficionado, but I was already starting to turn on these films. For one thing, I found them very rapidly to become kind of formulaic and interchangeable. That bothered me. They really weren't very good movies. That didn't mean I couldn't go to some, you know, trashy slasher movie and have a good time like everyone else, but basically, I got kind of bored by them. But also because I am, for good or ill, saddled with that thing called a critic brain, whatever that is. That's why I became a critic. You know, we sort of think about things, analyze things. And in my case, always trying to connect movies to the culture. I pretty quickly got onto the idea that these movies were actually having a coarsening effect on the culture, and it bothered me. I never thought it was the end of civilization. I'm still drawn to this day to extreme horror when it's really good. I love a movie like Audition, which I consider to be a brilliant, just masterpiece of modern horror. I thought that one movie from a number of years ago, the one with J-Lo in it, actually, before she was J-Lo, The Cell and Vincent D'Onofrio, I thought that was quite a good, really extreme horror movie. So I still have a taste for that. But I think the endless formulaic kind of horror film of just watching people get, you know, killed, as in a Saw film, in really brutal ways, and we have no investment, no even identification with them as human beings. I think that has a coarsening effect on the culture, and although it can sound like you're being just kind of finger-wagging and moralistic, I think more and more as time has gone on, some of my critiques of the coarsening effect of pop culture on our culture, I think that's come into focus more and more. I think, and it all fuses with franchise culture too. There have been incredibly great movies over the last 40 years. I think our culture continues to produce great cinema. That's one of the reasons I'm not a pessimist about it or a cynic or anything like that. But when you look at extreme horror, when you look at the deadening aspects of our franchise culture, when you look at how fantasy-based all of this stuff is, the kind of horror movies we were talking about had a certain grip because they felt reality-based. They took off from reality, even if they had a monster in it. Now, I feel like our horror films or things like Saw or whatever are just so over the top that there's not much reality left to them. And I think the culture of unreality that we've produced through pop culture in some ways has paved the way for someone like Donald Trump. I think we are less and less connected to reality through our pop culture. And in that sense, I have a sort of overarching critique of it. But I don't know what you do about it, because I am a First Amendment absolutist, and I do think that our movie culture has developed, because in some ways people vote with their ticket dollars, and that's what it's about.
See, it's funny, as you were talking about horror films, I was thinking the modern horror film would be the Donald Trump campaign film, but you know, I digress. I got to ask you, when you, and I hadn't thought about this while reading the book, and just crossed my mind now, when you went to the Boston Phoenix, basically your first, you know, paying job, your first full-time critical job, at an alternative weekly like that, or the Village Voice, or you know, the Chicago Reader, wherever city you are, you have one, Creative Loafing in the South. There, you're pretty much writing for a younger single person, you know, somebody who probably doesn't have kids. They're thinking about themselves, they're dating, whatever it is. When you switch from writing film reviews for a Boston Phoenix to an Entertainment Weekly, which is aimed at a broad audience, you know, parents, families, seniors, whatever it may be, did you have to, or did you, or did Jeff Jacobs or Jim Seymour, people that you worked for, did they give you any guidance and say, okay, you need to think it as you're writing these reviews, give us your opinion, but also it's a different audience than you had at the Phoenix.
Well, it's a great question. What I will tell you, first of all, is that thank God my editors never did say that. I think it might be different today. I think if somebody was coming from whatever world and went into a newspaper or a magazine that was more mainstream media, I mean, if they began in the sort of more alternative fringe culture, maybe with a blog or something like that, and then they found themselves at a magazine or at a daily newspaper, to the extent that daily newspapers still exist, I imagine at some point they would have an editor say, think about the audience. That never happened to me at Entertainment Weekly. More to the point, on my own, I never gave any of that a moment's thought. Seriously. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you why not. As I say in my book, I don't think I exaggerate the importance of film criticism. I think I know exactly how important it is. There's a lot of things that are more important than it is. But I always took it deadly seriously, and I saw it as a kind of mission. As soon as I connected with Pauline Kael's writing, and it was really reading her when I was in college that made me want to become a critic. I wanted to write like her. She was different to me than other critics. She had a sense of psychology, a sense of reality, a sense of just putting her own self out there that seemed to define almost a whole school of criticism. I mean, that's why I've said before, and I'll say it again, you know, there was great pop music before Elvis and the Beatles, but they changed everything. Pauline, to me, was like the Beatles of pop criticism, of film criticism. You could never go back after that. She seemed to invent a form. And I believed in that form with a certain missionary zeal. So when I became a critic, my goal at every moment, in every piece, was I want to do this. I want to call it like I see it. I want to write with as much depth and passion and hopefully amusement as possible, connect with my readers. And my point is that I was so possessed by this whole orientation toward criticism that I'm describing that I never had time or even the inclination to stop and think about who the audience was. I don't mean by that I didn't give a shit about my readers. In a sense, I would argue that by approaching criticism with an almost missionary zeal, I cared very much about my readers. I've always said that the main purpose of criticism, to me, it was never about the consumer guide thing, although that's there. It was about people, the idea of people after a movie, reading what you had to say, connecting with what you had to say, maybe debating it in their minds, having a dialogue with you. If they became your regular readers, almost thinking of you as their movie friend, that sounds a little corny, but you know what I mean. We do develop relationships with writers where we say, got to see what he's going to say. You read them every week. I feel this way about political columnists. So I read in the New York Times or whatever, or other critics. So that was all there. I felt very powerfully this idea of the reader out there. But my point is that I never thought about whether the reader was young or old or married or had a family or had this agenda. My idea was we are all united in thinking movies are this impossibly great art form, powerful even when they're not great, even when it is just a popcorn movie. It's out there in the culture. It's something that you want to know about, want to explore your feelings about. That was my job as a critic. I didn't want to be ageist or sexist or racist or anything else about it. I never thought I was writing to one race or one sex or one age. I thought I wanted to invite the largest possible audience in to read my reviews. But certainly one way that would translate at Entertainment Weekly when I got there is that I never went and saw a family film and wanted to write something lame like, well, I didn't like it very much, but if you've got a family, you'll like this movie. See it. You know, that just, I thought, you know, if that's the way you want to go, then you don't even need a person sitting there doing it. Just have, you know, just have the computer, a computer program, mark it as a family film and have families go see it. I always believed that the critic's job was to say exactly what you thought. And so, and I was lucky enough maybe to work at a time where even at a mainstream magazine like Entertainment Weekly in 1990, even amidst some of the controversy that I inspired when I started there with my review of Pretty Woman, which got all this attention because the magazine had such a rocky beginning, you know, I might have been, I'm probably lucky that my job was saved. I wasn't fired, but nobody ever called me on the carpet and said, you know, you got to think about, you know, forget about what you think. What about the people that like romantic comedies? What are they going to think? The problem with that kind of thinking is that it's such a slippery slope. The second you start thinking about the people who like romantic comedies or going to this movie and thinking about the people who like sentimental sports dramas or whatever, then you've left yourself behind and you're just handing out endorsements and you're really serving no purpose.
Now, that said, there did come a point at Entertainment Weekly where you became aware that they were very focused on the cover story and what personality was going to be on the cover story, and tying not necessarily, I didn't get the sense that reviews had to tie in to how puffy the cover story profile was, but that there was definitely an emphasis put on that connection, and that, you know, the editors had to live in a very kind of a slippery slope between, you know, if we pump up this actor or actress for their upcoming project, and then Owen or Lisa writes a scathing review 2 weeks later, well, they look kind of stupid at the magazine.
It did create awkward moments or awkward situations where we had to decide how to deal with that situation. But fortunately, and I say this with giving great credit to various editors I had at Entertainment Weekly from the top down, the solution they came up with was never, this is going to be a cover story. The reason it's a cover is that it's a terrific movie. You know, you better write a good review of it, or if you don't, you're now, okay, you didn't write a good review of it, but now you're officially in trouble. You're not a team player, all that stuff. We never got that. Now, what they did have to do is, if there are some magazines that, when they do a cover story, will kind of embed the review in the feature package along with, you know, here's the main bar of the feature. Here is a sidebar on this hot young actor who's in the movie. And now here's the box with the review in it. That became very standard at some magazines, and I mean, it was really Newsweek in, I think, the late 70s and early 80s that pioneered that. Then Time Magazine took that format and kind of ran with it, and I always felt in reading those pieces that there was a slippery slope, because in that kind of format, it does look silly to have a cover story on a magazine and even like a B-minus review. It's just, it looks awkward. If you run the same review in a different part of the magazine, this doesn't even make any sense, but somehow that seems more logical. Because what it's emphasizing, if you run the review in, you know, the back with the review sections, it emphasizes that the feature package and the review are two different things. And in fact, there's nothing wrong with a magazine running a cover story on a movie that its critic that ends up not liking. Once again, I was fortunate enough not to really have that pressure. And sometimes we even decided, if it was really a negative review, we would decide to hold the review to the following week, where it just looked less awkward. Mm. So there were awkward moments, but it was all a way of trying to avoid, you know, tamping down on what the critics could say. I would say that the way it works now is very different. I won't comment on how it works at Entertainment Weekly. I still think Entertainment Weekly is a good magazine. They have good critics. Chris Nashawaty, who's the main film critic there, is a friend of mine. I really respect his writing. I think they do a good job. But in general, in media, I think that kind of pressure is much, much more there now. And now, if a magazine were to run a cover package and the critic would not be in line, he might be able to get away with it for one review, but I think they would feel the awkwardness. I think they would feel that he is not with the program. And in general, as I talk about in my book, there are many more ways now I feel that critics feel like they need to be with the program than there used to be. Mm-hmm. However, ironically, a lot of them are coming from critics, not just editors.
Right.
I think there is a real kind of groupthink at work, and I think it comes from the ground up and the top down, and the result is that I think critics have all sorts of pressures on them today that they didn't have when I was at Entertainment Weekly. I think the pressure started at a certain point in the culture when I was at Entertainment Weekly, but because I had started there in 1990, when there was much less pressure, and because we created a whole culture at Entertainment Weekly of freedom and respect for criticism, I was almost grandfathered into this later era. As long as I was at Entertainment Weekly, I could say what I thought without pressure, and I did. And I think Lisa Schwartzbaum felt the same way. And we sometimes had to fight some battles to preserve it. But basically, that was the atmosphere there.
Well, let's go backwards. You mentioned you made reference to Pauline Kael, one of the deans, longtime deans of film criticism. But what was interesting to me is, and again, this comes back to my introduction where I talk about how there was so much, I felt parallel between our, and we've never met before today, but
That's right.
Was so much parallel in our young careers, and people don't know this about me. I've made my living as a writer and as of magazine articles and newspaper and books my whole life. So you were talking about Pauline Kael, discovering her when you were in college. For me, it was Nick Tosh's. Mm-hmm. Who I suddenly, went from writing, newspaper and magazine pieces, but then you read a book by Nick Tosh's, or you read an article by Nick Tosh's, and suddenly you go, holy crap, there's a whole nother way to do this.
That's
there's
right.
a whole nother thought. And I, like you, I made a pilgrimage to New York. You went to meet Pauline Kael.
I did.
I went to meet Nick Tosh's in the Village, went to interviewed him at his apartment in the Village, and it happened to be the day that Penthouse magazine sent over the nude Madonna photos. It just happened to be the same day. It was wonderful. anyway, but what I wondered is, tell people a little bit about how your relationship with Kael began. I mean, she had a profound influence on your career in terms of helping you have a career.
Well, she had a profound influence on my career, but one of the reasons that the beginning of my relationship with her, which consisted of writing her a fan letter, and I say in the book that it wasn't an act of careerism because I was the last one on earth who ever expected that she would return it. That is the literal truth. I mean, in the sense it was like writing, I considered her kind of a rock star. It was like, a teenager writing their fan gush to a rock star. You don't necessarily expect the lead singer of Motley Crue is gonna write you back. So that's what I did. Now, once we struck up a friendship and she started corresponding with me, and ultimately, out of the blue, after our correspondence seemed to have faded out, she called me in the house I was living at in college. I mean, literally, one of my roommates just said, "Oh, and there's a phone call for you. Pauline Kael's calling." I was like, what? It was like getting a phone call from God. At that point, I think a certain careerist mechanism kicked in the sense that I thought, this is a person of power I want to get to know. It still just grew out of my passion to want to meet her, because I was so obsessed with Pauline Kael. I mean, I fell in love with her writing when I was a freshman. And at that point, I wasn't thinking about being a film critic. I just knew I wanted to read her reviews. She was a revolutionary writer for me. I still think that she is a much more revolutionary writer in our culture than she's given a credit for. A lot of people would say she was the greatest film critic or the most talked about, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that she was hugely influential on journalism in the last 40 years, sort of the way that a figure like Tom Wolfe was. There was something about her prose and the way that it just seemed to embody these perceptions that went off like strings of firecrackers. There was something so electrifying about that, even when you didn't agree with her. That, I think, is part of the influence and the power of Pauline, and certainly what made me want to do what she did. So then, when I was lucky enough to get this phone call from her, not realizing that she was probably trying to recruit me to be one of her acolytes, I mean, I didn't realize at the time that there were many of them, I just seized upon the opportunity. I did go to New York sometimes on my own in college, and I was like, I'm going to be in New York over Christmas break. Are you going to be around there? And she said she was, and we got together. But from the moment I met Pauline, it was different than I expected and more awkward in a certain sense, because certainly I was, you know, as a college kid, kind of intimidated to be around this writer I admired, but she had a personality that was very domineering. I mean, from the moment that I, you know, was first talking to her the evening that we met, I recount this story in my book, I felt there was a certain pressure just in her personality for you to agree with her. She was incredibly insinuating. She just gave you a sense that she believed completely in what she thought and had a kind of contempt for what anyone else would think. I tell a story about how almost the first thing that Pauline ever said to me, I was in her hotel room in the Royalton Hotel right near where the New Yorker was. That's where she stayed when she was in New York. And I was trying to make polite conversation. She mentioned that she was in town for the meeting of the New York Film Critics Circle, which was the next day. This particular day we met was New Year's Day, and the voting meeting was going to be January 2nd. And just trying to make conversation, I said, oh, well, you know, what movie do you think is going to win? This was the very beginning of 1980. And she just looked at me and said, well, I hope to God it's not Kramer versus Kramer. Kramer versus Kramer had just come out just a few weeks before, you know, but it was one of those prestige movies that it comes out at the end of the year and then wins a bunch of awards, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That whole award season thing was already happening then. And I had just seen it a couple of weeks ago, and I had loved it. And I just, there was something about, not the fact that Pauline clearly wasn't that crazy about it, I didn't really care about that, but something about her tone that let me know that I should not at that point be saying, gee, I loved it. I did indicate that I liked it, and I said, well, why didn't you like it? And she said, well, she thought it was very bourgeois, which she thought about a lot of these kind of middle-class soap operas that Hollywood was starting to make. But she also really didn't like its theme. She said, you know, well, it's just about how fathering ennobles. And I had never heard the word ennobles before. But, you know, I had a pretty quick mind for a 19-year-old, and I had some daddy issues of my own. One of the themes of my book is that I had a very problematic father who was kind of a bully and a philanderer, and how that affected me. And I kind of thought to myself, well, doesn't fathering ennoble? I mean, wouldn't it be kind of, you know, kind of a great thing to be a great dad? That's kind of what Kramer versus Kramer says. I thought, what is so wrong with that? And it turns out that Pauline had a very different relationship to parenthood than a lot of people. She was a single parent, but kind of allowed her work life and her passions to dominate her. And I think didn't like a movie that said, it's just nice to be a nice stay-at-home dad or whatever. And, you know, right from the beginning, there were pressures to kind of see it her way. And I think this is reflected in the way that her acolytes ended up basically doing that, basically mirroring what she said. I felt that pressure from the first meeting, and it made my relationship with Pauline, which went on for a few years, always made it awkward. I always felt that pressure. I would sometimes disagree with her, but it was there. And the grand irony of it is that the pressure I was feeling, in a sense, was that I wanted to be myself. When I was around Pauline Kael, I mean, I agreed with Pauline on a lot of things. We had a lot of sensibility in common. That's one of the reasons I admired her so much. But when I didn't agree with her, I felt that very strongly, the best case in point being Brian De Palma. Carrie was one of the, in 1976, was one of the formative movies for me. I saw it when I was a freshman. It was the first Pauline review I ever read. And when I saw Carrie, it just blew my mind. It just possessed me. It was like drugs. It got in my system. I could think about nothing else. It turned my head around. It's, you know, my equivalent of like, I don't know, somebody saying the first time I ever heard the Velvet Underground or something like that. So I considered myself a Brian De Palma person. But I got myself onto the set of Dressed to Kill later on in college. And stood on the corner of Broadway and 53rd Street, a freezing January night. It was a later Christmas vacation, I remember. And I actually tried to talk to De Palma in the Sheraton Hotel during a break, and he was like, no, get out of here, kid. But I kind of thought that was cool about him because I worshipped him. Mm-hmm. Then Dressed to Kill came out. I think the first thing I saw was Pauline's review of it. She was over the moon. She basically said, this is like a Hitchcock movie, except it's better than a Hitchcock movie. It's more daring. It goes further, et cetera, et cetera. I saw Dressed to Kill and really didn't care for it at all. I liked the opening sequence that was a takeoff on Vertigo, but I found it sort of patched together, not very convincing. It didn't have that thing that Hitchcock's movies had, which was to, you know, in their sensational way, kind of just pull you into their reality and never let go. That's, to me, what defined Hitchcock as such an extraordinary filmmaker. So I came out of Dress to Kill in the summer of 1980, whatever it was. This was after I knew Pauline, probably 6 months after that initial meeting. And I was like, this is a piece of shit. I'm sorry. As a moviegoer, I've never been loyal to anything except my experience. That includes, like, auteurism. I have directors I revere and still revere, but it doesn't mean that if I see a movie by them I don't like, that I go, well, it was an Altman film. I must somehow figure out a way to fit it into the canon. No, I don't give a shit about that. It's a movie. It's just a movie. And if it's not good, say it. I loved Carrie. I still had a kind of reverence for De Palma and the whole idea of the kind of movies he was making, but I hated Dress to Kill. And that just wasn't the kind of thing that Pauline wanted to talk about. She believed in this film and this filmmaker so much that if you got around her and started, you know, dissing Brian De Palma, she wasn't going to be very happy with you, and you knew that. So that side of me that was just going to be true to my own experience, whatever filmmaker made the film, whatever Pauline Kael thought, that's the side, in a way, I learned from Pauline. That's what was so great about her writing. Her writing taught you to be fearlessly independent. So I ultimately had to break with Pauline Kael to be true to what she taught me. It was very, very paradoxical.
Well, one of the things that I think recurs throughout the book is that you always are you. I mean, you always, you know, it got you in trouble, whether it was the Boston Phoenix or there were some moments, I think, at Entertainment Weekly where you felt the need to be you and exert yourself as you. And, you know, sometimes it worked, but you're always you. I got that very clearly in the book.
Well, that is the theme of my book in a funny way. And one thing that I can say on your terrific show, because it's so intelligent and expansive and you have the room to kind of say it, and some other interviews I've done, I haven't really been able to get into this, but I think that idea of just being willing to be you, I think that that should be true of film critics, certainly. I think it's a problem that film critics feel that they can't be themselves, and I think in many ways, both big and small, they sometimes feel that they can't. But more to the point, I think it's a problem in society. I mean, I really think it is our duty, almost our religious duty, to be ourselves. That's all we are. That's all that we can be. I think, not to sound too grandiose about it, but our culture is full of far too much pressure on people not to be themselves. I think it's a big problem. I may be, in saying that, really reflecting my age, really reflecting my generation, in that I did grow up in the 1960s and 70s. I talk about in my book how I went through my leftist radical phase when I was 11, and I think that's a good age to go through it at. When I was in junior high, I carried around a transcript of the Chicago 7 trial and idolized those guys. I'd outgrown that by the time I was 12 and a half and became the sort of liberal centrist that I remain to this day. So I wasn't really that sentimental about the 60s. I saw through a lot of them, and I see through a lot of boomer piety and stuff like that. But I did take certain aspects of that era really with me, and one of them was the aspect of the 60s that I romanticized was this idea that you should tell the truth. The movies were full of that. You would watch the movies, the Hollywood movies or even documentaries that had started to come around after the late 60s. The early 70s, and what were they were about? They were about, I mean, this begins with things like The Graduate, they were about the idea that middle-class society, as it had evolved in the post-war era, as it had evolved in the 50s or whatever, you know, the whole Mad Men era and stuff like that, in some ways it was built on a lot of lies. It was built on lies about sexuality and keeping the races down and keeping these people down and just creating false images of things through advertising and stuff like that. The 60s were about tearing a lot of that down. The 60s were, at their best, were about saying, let's tell the truth about stuff. Let's tell the truth about how corporations work. Let's tell the truth about how governments work. Let's tell the truth about the relationship between the sexes and try to make it better. Let's tell the truths about race in America, about our history, and try to make it better. There was a whole truth-telling impulse that I really believed in and still do. And in some ways that never went away, but then as the culture developed after that, the new lies began to be kind of advertising based. Our fashion culture, just, you know, wear these clothes. I mean, in other words, fashion culture would tell you, wear such and such clothes and you'll be cool, or something like that. Now, I don't personally think there's any crime in that. I mean, I believe in fashion, and you want to dress a certain way, create a certain image. I'm not a prude about that. That's great. But our culture became so advertising-based that that paradigm began to spread over to ideas. Not just, you know, wear these jeans or whatever and you'll be cool. Think this thought and you'll be cool. Like this band and you'll be cool. Have this kind of conversation with, and you'll be cool, and this is what you want to do. This to me was just bullshit, because this was allowing your words and maybe your even thoughts to be formed by something up there. I guess we could call it the man or whatever. But I have a serious problem with that. It's never the way I want it to be. I do think just being yourself is what we were meant to be. And I think one of the reasons I became a critic is that I think that's what criticism stands for. Criticism doesn't stand for having this opinion on a movie or that opinion on a movie or just recommending movies. It stands for really saying what you think, the same way that good political writing does, or probably any good kind of writing. So, yeah, I really do believe that. And I think in some ways in our culture, not to overstate it, but we're now, especially with social media and stuff like that, I mean, social media ideally should be about people through these various things, Facebook, Twitter, asserting who they are. Mm-hmm. It seems to be. But in many ways, I think that social media is all about positioning. It's all about people saying things that they maybe don't necessarily believe, but what they think they're supposed to believe. So I think that our culture, in many ways, I'm sounding way on my high horse here, but I really do believe that our culture, in many ways, is encouraging people more than ever not to be themselves. And I don't get it. And I think we'd be better off. And I do think, look, we do have, as a result of this, I can't even tell you how it's connected, but on some spiritual karmic level, I think it is. We do now have a political culture, clearly, of such awesome fraudulence that it's really threatening to hurt us. I mean, this idea that, you know, Trump can literally get up there and say anything, anything under the sun, and half the people maybe will vote for him. Clearly, let's leave aside Trump the man, who I actually have a certain affection for. I mean, I think he is a good performer or whatever. In a sense, the whole Trump phenomenon, the whole thing we're talking about this, is not about Donald Trump the man. Donald Trump the man is what he always was. Kind of a bozo, kind of entertaining, probably smarter than he, than we give him credit for, but on some level, a bombastic know-nothing. The man hasn't changed. What has changed is the electorate, the citizens, our society. All these people who, in a way that might not have happened 15 or 20 years ago, are willing to say, sure, I'll vote for Donald Trump, and I'll vote for him whatever the hell he says. Doesn't even matter. You know, I think that fraudulence in our society has gained in power, and I think it grows out of the advertising culture, and it grows out of the culture that tells everybody not to respect who they are, not to respect the reality of who they are. If we don't respect who we are inside, we start to lose touch with reality as a society. That's what I'm saying. I realize this sounds either awfully pompous or awfully like, you know, too much smoking dope, but I'm just saying it on your show because I really do believe these things, and I do believe on some level that the way we see movies is all connected to it. That's why I do think that we now, where movies used to represent a culture of reality, they now represent a culture of fantasy. That is a huge seismic change in movie culture, and I think it represents an underlying seismic change in our culture overall.
Well, as we kind of wind towards the end, rounding third, if you will, and heading to home.
I think this is an hour-long interview in which I've only given three answers. I apologize for that. I am awfully long-winded.
You're fine.
You can see how frustrated I was at Entertainment Weekly when I only got to say 500 words on a review. I'm like, fuck, that's just one paragraph.
That's why I couldn't be a newspaper writer anymore. To go from, you know, once in a while having a lot of space to write a long piece to everything having to be 10 inches or less, that's just, you know, not going to happen. But here's what I'm wondering. For a time, Esquire magazine would go back to its archives, look at its fashion choices over the years, and write an Esquire regrets column.
Yeah, right.
Right? And now you've reviewed and liked and disliked an enormous number of films over the years. And what I wondered is, what would be a couple of films that you regret slobbering over and a couple more that you regret not liking on first sight?
Well, I will say this. I've learned that readers over the years love it when you go back and you write a column about how you disagreed with yourself. They just love, I think we still, one of the things I talk about in the book is we still, we so much come at critics with this idea of the critic that was probably formed in with the character of Addison DeWitt and All About Eve, the critic as just this, you know, fancy-talking sourpuss who's kind of taking his vengeance out on the world. I think that that whole image of the critic is still with us. We have modern versions of it. And so when people see that a critic can admit that he or she is wrong, they really like that. It humanizes us. I don't. There's not that many examples where I have terrible regrets. There's one little movie. I can't remember what it's called. It's one that nobody's even heard of. But anyway, it was a drama about rave culture that showed at Sundance. And I saw it on No Sleep at midnight. And ironically, because I could barely keep awake, I somehow... The movie kept me awake, and I thought it had this incredible vibe to it, and I wrote this rave review of it. 7 months later, it came out. I had to see it again and actually write a review of it for Entertainment Weekly, and I saw that it was just this scrappy, not very good movie that didn't live up to the experience I had of it at all, and I was quite embarrassed by what I'd written. There were other examples like that of Festival Fever, but for me, in terms of movies where I've changed my mind, the granddaddy of them all, and I write almost to devote a whole chapter to this, is Moulin Rouge, which I saw right when it was coming out. I mean, I went to a screening. I liked some of it. I mean, some of it I did find enchanting. But I found much of it shrill and off-putting. I decided in the end that though I did like things about it, it was almost the definition for me of a mixed bag of a movie. I wrote about it in Entertainment Weekly, and I believe I gave it a grade of B-, something like that. It was in the fall of 2001, and I never looked back. And when the time came a few months later to do my 10 best of the year list, I knew Moulin Rouge wasn't close to making the cut, and I didn't think about it. And I think my movie of the year that year was Memento. Well, anyway, a few months after that, in about, I think it was February, I was with a friend, and she wanted to go see Moulin Rouge. And I said, all right, I'll go see it with you. I'll see it again. Which I occasionally did. I was kind of curious about it. It is an interesting film. So we went to see it, and I was blown away. I got absolutely caught up in it in that magical, spellbinding way that you want. And I saw how the movie worked, which is some of it is, I put quotes around this, shrill and off-putting, especially the first 40 minutes, but kind of on purpose. Because Moulin Rouge, in addition to this being a visionary musical, I loved it because it is a great movie about love. And an unusual movie about love for Hollywood. It's not a, you know, sentimental rom-com. It's about how, you know, love is this thing we all crave and we search for, but the world is so cold without it. That was its point. And so it had to keep going back and forth between Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman sort of being together and feeling in love and then going to how they feel when they can't be together. And so it sort of threw you in and out of this hot and cold thing. That's part of the way that movie works. Anyway, I just saw it, and I said to myself, oh, my God, if I could do this all over again, it would absolutely be my best movie of the year. And I just thought I blew it. Once again, it's not a matter of great importance whether I left Moulin Rouge off my 10 best list. But as a critic, I really was kind of aghast. I said, my God, I wasn't doing my job. And that actually began a new ritual for me, which is that I, from that point on, about 15 years ago, I would not let the end of the year approach without rewatching a number of films to see what I thought about them the second time, because I just didn't want to make a mistake like that. And I discovered that films can change over time. Probably the biggest ways that movies change for me is that sometimes if I think a movie is pretty good, you'll see it again and you'll go, no, it's very good. The reservations you have about it drop away. The flaws don't matter anymore, or you see that they weren't even flaws. And so I like to see films a second time. I had a surprise this year. I'll tell you a perfect example of how I saved myself. The Mad Max film, I did like very much the first time. And I kind of said, yeah, that's going on my 10 best list. I think he really brought it. But my line on it when I came out of it was I said, it's not as great as Road Warrior because in some ways it just took the vision from Road Warrior and, you know, and then kind of redid it for our era. But I felt, going back to my Moulin Rouge principle, I said, got to watch it again. So I watched Mad Max Fury Road a second time at home, just on my, you know, regular size TV. And to my surprise, it got better. It got even better. I saw that where I knew that Road Warrior was this big leap over Mad Max in terms of just being a different kind of vision. I saw that Fury Road was more of a different vision than I thought. It looked like the Road Warrior, you know, the sort of sandy wilderness wasteland and all of that. But everything about the speed, about how the nihilism was just ratcheted up, I was like, no, he did something different here. And he took on a vision of its own. And I made it, as a result of that second viewing, my number two film of the year. It would never have been that high. So it's an example of why, you know, critics are fallible. And in some ways, we're supposed to see everything the first time, but it's like falling in love. You know, you're going to – takes a while to really get to know this person that you're with, and it can take a while to get to know a really – great movie and to see how great it is.
Is that a fault in the basic review system that we've been in for decades, that you basically get one shot to write the movie, to watch the movie, form your opinion, and then you have to move on, partly because there's so much you have to see, and partly because, you know, you're seeing it in a screening facility, the studio is paying for that facility. You don't really usually correct me if I'm wrong, but usually you get one shot to see the movie. You don't get to see it over and over.
I would say where that's not actually quite true, especially if you're lucky enough to live on one of the coasts and stuff, is that, I mean, for a lot of movies, for popcorn movies, you get one shot. I think that the second movies are a little more prestigious, and by that I could be talking about an end-of-the-year awards film, something like Spotlight or The Revenant, say, or, you know, going back, a movie like Saving Private Ryan or whatever. Those movies, even as a critic, where you're going to be reviewing it in a timely fashion, if you want, you do have a chance to see it a second time. If I had said, I want to see The Revenant a second time, I felt like I'd seen it a second time after I saw it once.
was it repeating on you like a Mexican dinner? What are you saying?
It was. It was repeating the tedium, unfortunately. But if you want to do that, you can. So there are opportunities, and I've always done that as a critic. There are certain films that I have the opportunity to see twice and will do that before I write on them. I did that this year. Writing for the BBC on Carol, which was my favorite film of the year, Todd Haynes' film. I saw it twice before I wrote about it. But in a lot of ways, there are a lot of films you don't have the opportunity to see twice. And I guess what I would say to that is, yes, I think that's a flaw that's built into the system. It's probably an inherent flaw. In other words, if movies are going to be reviewed in a timely fashion, you simply don't have the luxury of seeing it, meditating on it, seeing it again, and then writing your equivalent of, you know, a long piece for Film Comment. That's not what the daily or magazine beat of film criticism is about. What I will say is that flaw that has always been built into the system has been unnecessarily, and by critics in a way, ratcheted up in the last few years, in that the pressure now is not just that you have to make up your mind about everything you think after one viewing. It's that it has to happen so instantaneously. Twitter, I think, has had a bad effect on film criticism in a number of ways, and one of them is that people come out of screenings at festivals and are tweeting their responses. Sometimes they're tweeting their responses in the middle of a screening, and the whole impulse there in our era of instant media is everybody wants to be first. So it's like taking what would have been the ordinary legitimate timeliness of good journalism and taking it almost to an infantile level. Being timely is fine, but saying, I'm first, I'm the first one to announce that this movie I just saw at a festival rocks. And my point is that impulse becomes so powerful that it can end up dictating the opinion, because you're really bringing the news if you say something is great. So you come out of a festival screening and say, this is great, and suddenly everybody's saying it's great. Twitter also has that influence of making people kind of think like other people, and suddenly everybody's going... Everybody wants to be the first out of the gate to say, this is great, and they're falling all over themselves. And in that sense, that's an example of how the whole process has been corrupted, and what's missing is a little bit of meditation time, because I do believe that is inherent in good criticism. Having your feeling, but then meditating, coming down off it. And that can happen in interesting ways. When I first saw Spotlight, I was like, yeah, this is great. Oh, man, it's just feeding my nostalgia for All the President's Men, and it's about when newspapers matter. I mean, it touched all my kind of key passion points. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, yeah, it's a good movie, but it's not great. I didn't feel real passionate about it. I did watch it a second time, according to my Moulin Rouge principle, and sure enough, if anything, it looked a little less good. because I do think that the major characters, they could have been developed more. It's not all the President's Men. It was about a story that's a very important story, obviously, but it was kind of old news. All the President's Men came out 2 years after Watergate. Spotlight came out 12 or 13 years after the Boston Globe investigation that it was about. So if you just are a person who follows the news, that was really old news. So, you know, there are reasons to meditate. And another reason I use Spotlight as an example is that at the Toronto Film Festival, which is where it first showed, I believe, I was there. I didn't see it till after that. But, I mean, everybody was just creaming over it. I mean, it was just, it had become the thing. And in some ways, that whole instant nature of judgment, everybody searching for a masterpiece, all of that feeds together with something like that. And the result is a loss, perhaps a loss of perspective. But, you know, look, it won the Oscar. A lot of people would say, no, it was a great movie. So what do I know? I'm not really trying to beat up on Spotlight. I'm just trying to say that, yes, the more time, the better. And there isn't enough time often to meditate as you should as a critic, and probably less so than ever these days.
And so, Owen, as we kind of wrap up, you're promoting your book, Movie Freak. What else are you doing these days?
I'm trying to think about what comes next. I really had a great time writing this book. I mean, it was the first book that I ever wrote. And if I can say something about it, without being too pretentious.
Sure.
You know, when you're trying to write a book and trying to structure it and trying to take something like your own life story and turn it into a story, I was like, well, how am I going to do that? I had certain memoirs that I consulted and looked at and was influenced by. One in particular that just kind of shadowed me was Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, because it's such a great book.
Yeah.
And sort of about, you know, a kind of career in a way. So it had a certain influence. But in some ways, the biggest influence, I think, was indie film, in a certain way, for lack of a better term, because it is a book in which, in addition to talking about the whole movie thing, I do get very honest about my personal life. I didn't think I was being that revealing, but I've had a lot of people say to me, my God, dude, you were really candid in that book.
You were.
I have had some people accuse me of oversharing, but I didn't do it to be an exhibitionist. I did it because of that individuality thing that you and I were talking about. I feel that to be a good film critic and to tell the story of being a film critic, it's all about the individual that I was, and I wanted to talk about who that person was in all his flaws, and not gratuitous flaws, to be able to say, this kind of person I am, this sort of person who's obsessive in a lot of ways, maybe, you know, in my relationships and things like that, this is the kind of person who becomes a movie freak, or at least did at one point. So there was a purpose to all of that. But the other thing is, in terms of when I was saying about being influenced by indie film, I just thought about a lot of the great independent films I'd watched over the last 25 years. I don't think they're necessarily greater than some of the great films of the 70s, but one of the ways that they're different is they're more personal. When we think of 70s films, we think of movies like Chinatown, Dog Day Afternoon, Godfather, Nashville, movies that were about society, although they also had great characters. When you think about a movie like Welcome to the Dollhouse, in some ways that's about society, but really it's this very squirmy, personal story in which Todd Solondz, in a certain way, told aspects of his own story, or at least you felt that he did. And that's what was great about it. And I thought, my God, what is one of the things that's so great about these independent filmmakers that I have revered and championed for years is that they are so honest. They are so personal. They lay it on the line. And I said, that's my goal, is to do that, and ultimately not to do it in an indulgent way, but quite the contrary. That what those great filmmakers did was to tell their own stories or some spiritual version of them and to make it fun, to make it entertaining. That's certainly the filmmaker's duty. If it's not engaging, then you're not succeeding. I worked very hard to make every page of this book engaging, and that was the goal. And I had, whether or not I succeeded, I had such a good time doing it that I think, yeah, I could see doing another book. I'm not 100% sure. I have a few ideas, but I would not mind going in that direction.
Very cool. Well, folks, listen, you can find Owen Gleiberman's latest book, his first book, Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you are watching the show on MRMedia.com, you probably already know this, but to the left or right below the video screen is a copy of the book. You can click on it. It'll take you to Amazon. You can download the book automatically. They can get it to you in 30 minutes or less, I think, via Droid. No, I'm just kidding. Or you can have it in a day or two, physical copy. So do that. Order it now. Owen, is there a website? Is there social media where people can find you?
You know, I have a Facebook page for my book. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Owen Gleiberman. All those places. Get in touch, please. I love hearing from folks.
Find the man. Owen, it was a really fun book to read. I think I made a note to myself that it may be the most bookmarked book I have ever had as, you know, related to a guest interview. I didn't even get to talk to you about, we both went to Michael's Pub as teenagers looking for Woody Allen on a Monday night.
Yeah.
You mentioned Carrie, the scene with I saw Carrie in at a drive-thru, and the scene of John Travolta and Karen Allen in the drive-thru. I won't go into it too much, but I kept thinking, I'm not getting enough out of my drive-thru experience. I can't wait till I can – yeah. So anyway, it was a pleasure to talk to you. I enjoyed the book, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thanks, Bob. Really a pleasure talking to you too, seriously.
Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of movie fans who agree with me that The Hollywood Nights is the most underrated movie of the last 40 years and that Robert Wool deserves the Kennedy honors in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.